I ran into a gentleman just as we were breaking up, Lee and Kirkpatrick, okay? And he's a member of this church and a member of the leadership, and he was here as they built this building and can tell us something about that. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I wasn't actually here when they built the building, but I've studied its architecture at great length because it fascinates me. And just to add to a few things Paul mentioned, the Celtic cross in the ceiling is actually structural steel, and it's holding the roof up. And if you go to Google satellite view, it's actually visible from the air. Presbyterian is a Reformed tradition, and so we're, you know, kind of minimize the suffering and the crucifixion and maximize the resurrection. And so I'm fascinated that all of the stained glass in this sanctuary is post-resurrection scenes from the life of Christ. And they're even in chronological order. In the far back on this side is Mary Magdalene at the tomb. The next window is the two men on the road to Emmaus, then doubting Thomas. Then this large stained glass over there is what I refer to as the first breakfast. Christ building a bonfire on the shore and the men dragging the overfull nets in. A comment I made to when Paul was talking about how this feels very traditional, the thing I like is the two large stained glass windows here actually, for me, create the illusion of a transept without actually having one. And this stained glass is the Great Commissioning. And then the next one is Christ asking Peter three times, "Do you love me?" And then the Ascension. And then in the far back, Saul's conversion on the road to Damascus. Another thing I guess I'd like to point out is, you know, all of this was very intentional. As you leave, there's six small stained glass windows in the narthex, that one each for the six mercies from Matthew. You know, feed the hungry, water for the thirsty, etc. The intention of those small windows is to remind us as we leave that we are going out to serve.
Yeah.
I would just like to ask for your prayers for Gary and Mary Becker. They've both been very regular attenders here for many years. Gary, for the last couple of years, has been housebound, and he is now, about to pass into the next life. So if you would hold them in your prayers, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Maybe you better.
All right, just a couple of small points. All of the stained glass except the Christ risen window, that's what we call that, are what I would call normal stained glass. The Christ risen window is what's called prism cut stained glass, and it creates a much more dramatic effect as the light gets reflected around different ways. And then the one other comment, Paul was talking about the base relief logo in the parish hall. There's a banner of the same thing over here that is the logo of our church. And because the subject is the Trinity, the flames, which represent the Word of God, if you will, the smoke and the pillar of fire in the desert, the burning bush. But the way they're organized is they create a triangle to remind us of the Trinity. Okay, those were actually carved by a parishioner many, many years ago. There's one shield for each of the apostles with a representation of what we best think of as their trade. And then there's four shields for the gospel writers. We changed the permits with the liturgical season, so this is, you know, the common time. And this is loaves and fishes, and I believe the one on the lectern is the deer drinking water from one of the Psalms. Yeah, the banners that are hanging here, again, change with the liturgical seasons. And these are just kind of generic. The word and song, and Alpha and Omega, bread and the cup, you know.
See how carefully they thought this out? See how deliberately they thought this out? Almost any building this large and this expensive, there's a lot of thought that goes into it. And sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not. And sometimes it's tribal. All of those shields on the wall, if we were in an Orthodox church, the wall would be here. The priests and the altar would be hidden behind there, and they would be icons of the saints. And so each of the Christian tribes will utilize art in different ways and to different extents. Tom, could I put you on the spot and have you talk a little bit about music working in the same way as the stained glass does? And you got to come to the microphone. I've been waiting to say that to him.
Well, I don't have any prepared remarks about music, but I will tell you what I've been involved in lately. And it has to do with our concepts of sacred and secular. You know, we do talk a lot about the difference, the hierarchical difference. And as an old music librarian, I used to classify and catalog music, printed music. And it was very interesting the way the Library of Congress decided to classify these things. The whole universe of secular music starts the alphabet going with the 100s, the M meaning music, 100s being solo instrumental music, and then the 200s being duets, and the M300s being trios, all solo, all instrumental. And it wasn't until we got to the thousands that we actually got into vocal music, M1000 and so and so. And the numbers keep cascading upwards, and before you know it, you get to M1500 and you're in operas, but you're still not in sacred music. Sacred music, you see, is way up there on the totem pole of classification. And when you get to M2000 is when you begin to say, I'm suddenly looking at scores of cantatas and oratorios and requiems and masses upon masses of masses, right? Sung masses. So most people never even realize that this issue was there. But I grew up in a world of classified music in which the top dog was what's called sacred music, and everything else kind of was there too. But now, what I've been doing with a singer friend of mine named Carol Ann Manzi, M-A-N-Z-I, is experimenting. We sing a lot of the stuff that I accompany her on guitar, but we sing a lot of the stuff which is considered, you know, pop and show tunes, and you would call it secular. There isn't any place in there that talks of God directly. But we have an album out now with 13 different songs, and the title of it is Secular Songs for Sacred People. We decided to flip it. It's the songs that are secular. It's the people that are sacred. And so there are, you know, I can't think of all these instantly, but when Paul was talking, I thought of one, which is the suffering question. He raised the question of suffering. And I thought, you know, we have a song from the Fantastics in which the lyric goes like this: deep in December, it's nice to remember, without a hurt, the heart is hollow. And, you know, I thought to me, you mentioned it to him, and he said, well, this is important. You've got to share this. And so I said, fine. But there are many other places in secular music. I mean, I do hospice volunteer work, and I find two of the most popular secular songs that people on their deathbed want to hear. One of them is that thing you mentioned about looking out the window at the trees. I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. So you can still acknowledge a gift even if you're not a believer. So, and the other one that gets a lot of play, it seems to me, is, well, there's two others. One is Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. You know, it's not gaudy, it's not religious, but it certainly is spiritual.
Yeah.
And the other one that I find surprising, but in a certain demand, a certain readiness to hear this, is from Porgy and Bess, the opera. And it's a lullaby, and it's called Summertime. And the living is easy. Fish are jumping and so on. The cotton is high. Kind of portrays a nice state of being. And then it goes into this. One of these mornings, says the mother to her child, one of these mornings you're going to rise up singing and spread your wings and take to the sky. Until that morning, there is nothing can harm you with your daddy and mammy standing by.
You all sing pretty good. A couple of thoughts. Each one of the different states we've been talking about, like the state that's induced by music, or the one induced by seeing stained glass, or the mindfulness of paying attention to the present, all of the contemplation, all of those different states have what the researchers call steady state knowledge. I think I'm getting that close to right, that phrase. State-specific knowledge, that's what it is. There are things that you can learn by singing or hearing songs that you cannot translate into rational thought. That's partially, perhaps, why right now we're quiet. Because what we learned in the state of music is only learned in the state of music. Okay? And there's more than one state, obviously. There's something called the hokey pokey. That would be a different state than what Tom was talking about. So each one of those has its value, but translating from one to the other is hard. There are things that we learn in prayer that cannot be expressed in rational language. And so the language of the rational world is one of argumentation, oftentimes, and precise thought. Well, that's different from the language of appreciation. Those are two different languages. And it's very hard to translate from one into the other. So I think we can certainly leave early and keep visiting. But I wanted to leave with you a sense that each one of those states, each one of those places has intrinsic value. And at least if I'm preaching at All Saints and you come, you are more than welcome to daydream. Okay? Thank you.
take any questions.
I would, but I'm not sure there are any. So.
Are there any? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just curious if you have any reflection on the shape of the spaces in our churches. I'm thinking of, you know, there are, in the Orthodox tradition, things are more in the round, in the sense that, you know, we've had these churches that go on forever in a cross shape, whereas they are more in a round. Mm-hmm. What does that do to our sense of
interesting,
community?
Isn't it? Yeah. Often Orthodox churches will be a dome. And inside that dome, Christ will be looking down on you. Depending on how you're feeling, maybe blessing you or condemning you, one of the two. And then there'll be an open space. It's actually usually rectangular, but it doesn't have to be. But the dome creates a sense of roundness. And I think creates a sense of centeredness. Look at the Celtic circle inside the cross. It gives you a sense of centeredness in that space, okay? It almost sets it aside as a holy space, in the sense of being centered, in the sense of being where we all focus. The Orthodox Church is perhaps always a mystery to some of us in the West, because in a true Orthodox Church, there are no chairs. There may be seats along the side for the elderly, who are older than I used to think they were. I am now elderly, my earlier lights. But people often come and go, because the services that are often behind that screen may go on for 2 or 3 or 4 hours. Luxury of going to Mount Athos once upon a time in northern Greece, where there are a lot of Orthodox monasteries, and I was coming back to meet my wife on the night before Easter. Okay, and I went into a railroad station in Thessaloniki, and they have chapels everywhere, but they had a chapel in the railroad station, with a television set put in the entrance to the chapel, okay, an old, thick, ugly television set. And the Archbishop of Athens, the head of the church, the Greek Orthodox Church, was starting the service at the cathedral in Athens. In Athens. So I look at that, and I get on the train, and I travel for 4 hours. I get out of the train, I grab a taxi. He said, I can't take you to a hotel because so many people are walking the streets, but it's 4 blocks this way, and that way. So in the process of trying to find my hotel, which I found later that night, I found the cathedral, the Orthodox Cathedral. And it's blocked off, and it turns out there are television sets and generals and the president of the country and everybody on this big platform. And I get there, and the doors of the great cathedral are thrown open, okay? And the Archbishop comes out. That means the service went on for 6 hours. And just incidentally, it was quite a show, because then the military band started. La, 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 boom. La, 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 boom. And everybody, including the president and all the generals, marched behind the Archbishop as they took the banner of the church and the icons around the town, proclaiming the great holiday. So I'm just telling that story because I loved it, but it's a whole different way of doing church. And they also love the arts, but it does different things. So not all of it comes across at the same. I think this is an extraordinarily thoughtful church, this particular one. Have any of you been back up in New England and seen the churches, the Revolutionary War churches up in New England? They're very bright, they're very light, they're very plain. Those are really designed for lectures. Very much so. They're beautiful, but it's very, very much that way. Any other comments, questions? Okay.
It's so small, I was going to say, it doesn't seem worth coming all the way up, but if you couldn't hear me before, I was just going to say those New England churches also, people bought their pews.
Yes.
And they had doors, little doors.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I sat in somebody else's pew and did not realize it until all of a sudden I was sort of, it just came over me halfway through. I'm not supposed to be here. But the people were extremely gracious to me. I was very young at the time.
Wow.
I was barely out of my teens. But I sort of went, oh, I'm sorry. I sat there because it looked so comfortable. It had nice pillows. So people really fixed up their pews to mm-hmm. make themselves mm-hmm. comfortable mm-hmm. and sat in the same pew every single Sunday. And I've noticed that in our church. People always try to sit in the same pews and look a little bit miffed. They walk down the aisle and, whoop, somebody's sitting there. Somebody's in my space. So there must be something in all of us. Well, there is, of course. We like to do what we've done always, and we feel that the space is important to us because we've mm-hmm. left something of ourselves in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's also something perceptual in terms of people's different ears and eyes. That you will come into a place and you will usually, often, sit in the same place. And you prefer that place and it feels right to you after a while. So there's a lot of reasons that probably go into that.
In our church, all I care about is not getting behind one of those pillars. And I always, when I come late, I'm always stuck behind a pillar. So I'm going this way and that way.
That's our punishment for
I
you.
I think the architect goofed a little bit there.
I don't know we had an architect. It was built a little here, a little there. Come on forward. And a little bit dab here, a little dab there, a little dab there. It was just simply a mission church for the people who were at the resort.
Hi, yeah. I'm Gloria. I just got back from an incredible experience, but I first wanted to say about 50 years ago, I received communion at St. Joseph's Church downtown. It's since burned down. It was a Franciscan church, and I had my first communion on Christmas Eve, and they had a live stable with donkeys, sheep. It was incredible. They took it literally because Francis brought in that whole thing about the manger and the incarnation. And this last week, my friend Barbara and I went to Scottsdale to experience a consecration of a new church called Our Lady of the Angels. And I'm asking to check it out on YouTube. I think it's wherever, whatever they say. Anyway, it was the most incredible experience. I don't even know if I can explain it all. It's a church in the round, which is an ancient thing. But they brought the ancient back to contemporary. It was very simple, but the stained glass windows were nondescript, but just gave you a sense, say, of Mary. Mm-hmm. So you could feel what you wanted to feel. And they had the Hubble, the picture of the Milky Way at the top. I guess that's like God.
Yeah.
And then they had Mary, and then they had a DNA swirl. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. And then they had these little pieces of stained glass all around, so you could sit anywhere and have an experience.
Yeah.
And then they had Francis and Claire in life size, not bigger, mm-hmm. but life size, mm-hmm. talking. And then they had real hay somewhere behind the altar. I mean, it didn't look like real hay, but it was. But everything had a value and a meaning to it because we took a tour. It was like when you walk in, you had a felt sense. There's no way to describe it. It was just beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to say, I guess that's it. I thought the Hubble telescope was really profound.
Yeah.
And I think they also brought incense in with sacred dancers.
Okay.
Where the incense was coming up.
Interesting.
Anyway, that was it. But I ask you to check it out on the YouTube. Thank you.
Thank you. That's great.
I'm just wondering, I was interested about this book you were talking about and how you said up in Washington, was it, where they had people that were doing like pre-Vatican II type of services. I have a grandson that's up there, and he takes that in, and he's a contemplative. And I don't know, I'm wondering if there's some kind of draw inward that he's young. He's 23 years old, and what is that that pulled him in that direction, that he really, is there more in this book about that sort of thing?
There is some in the book, and I've got a copy of it over there if you want to look at it when we're done. I think there's definitely something going on. I think this younger generation, many of them have been raised and never gone, your son, your grandson may well, but a lot
of
them
wasn't catechized at all until he was
never been to a church at all.
Yeah.
And when I was coming out of seminary many years ago, we were taught how to debate people in other denominations, because that's where the converts came from. Nowadays, the vast majority of people come into church and have never been there before. And so what I think is happening is that, you know how most things take steps? You know, you usually don't go from here to there in one, unless you're Superman, one long bound, and you take steps. You know all those kids who say they're spiritual but not religious? Give them 10 more years. Because what's happening now is they're getting like the smell of cookies being baked, okay? And they're kind of beginning to check it out. And then they're very privately, maybe I'll meditate, but no one's going to know it. My church in Seattle was downtown church, and it's more now, but we started to see the 20, 25-year-olds, 30-year-olds coming to church almost like this. And they would come, and they would sit in back, and then they'd slowly talk to us, and they'd keep coming back. And then they'd tell us that they wanted to come to church. Was that all right? We said, yeah, probably. And then after a couple months and 6 months, they'd say, I don't tell anybody at work I come here because everybody will laugh at me. Okay. What's going on is that the young world has just rejected the church because, number one, we're old fuddy-duddies, remember? Okay, never mind. But the other thing is, let me ask you a question. If the only thing you knew about the church was an angry fundamentalist preacher saying we're going to go to you know where, or maybe a really strict bishop wagging their finger at us, why, given those two models, would anybody in their right mind ever go to church? I'm sorry. If that's the only thing I knew about church, I wouldn't go either. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that maybe some young people avoid the church, it's all based on stereotypes.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes, I don't know about you, but I had to get older before I quit thinking just in stereotypes. You know, I still do too much, but when I was young, I thought more in stereotypes. I had to get older to kind of see that maybe all those folks on the other side were kind of interesting. And so my prediction against everybody else's prediction is that the spiritual but not religious, in the case of many young people, is leading them back into some of this dark space. And I think there's reasons for hope. Yeah.
I think maybe, too, there's something, a real draw for reverence and ritual besides the space. Yep. I mean, I think
besides the space,
that,
it all goes, you're right, it all goes together. Yeah. Ritual puts us into an altered state.
Yeah.
You know, the Protestant Reformation was anti-ritual, so that went out with the buildings. But if you do ritual, look at all the people now who put a little corner in their house and make that their ritual space with their pictures and the candle. And people are hungry for ritual. They're hungry for dark space. And they're also hungry, by the way, not just for that. Once they feel safe, they're hungry for human companionship. That's where the rest of it comes in.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think that's really well said. I think much of the stuff is stuff that we know implicitly, but haven't quite. Yeah.
With due respect to the architecture of churches, one of the most spiritually uplifting experiences I ever had was watching it was actually a video. of the blessing of the animals in a large church in, I think, in New York. Where went? St. John the Divine.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
God. They had dromedaries and other all kinds of animals marching and music. And it, boy, I'll tell you, I believed in creation that day. Like, you wouldn't. Oh.
They're famous for the blessing of the animals and dromedaries and mules and elephants.
That's right.
Place is so big that you can bring an elephant in there. And that's right. These places are meant not just for meditation, but for all kinds of different things going on. I'm just arguing that meditation is one of them. You need to pray in a church. You need to have baptisms. You need to have communion. You need to have funerals. You need to have weddings. You need to have them full of life. And certainly, the blessing of the animals is one of those. We did that a couple of weeks ago. This year, it seemed to be all Labradors. And one cat huddling in its cage, and one turtle that was about this big, and our sexton had to carry the turtle in because he was heavy, okay? So he put the turtle, and of course nobody's paying attention to the service, he put the turtle down, and the turtle didn't move, but he just kind of looked around, and the Labradors would come up with their behinds up and their heads down on the ground, kind of sneaking up to it, and then they'd stop just short of where they thought the thing might snap at them, and then they'd look at it with wide eyes, and then they'd back away. I have no idea what the sermon was. But that was the sermon, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah. So these are places where human life has to happen. But yeah.
As we're talking, I'm thinking so many of the things you're talking about have to do with our senses and
yep.
and
yep.
like the Reformation and so forth.
Yep.
Our bodies were evil.
Yeah.
And so we've truly become disconnected from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so these kinds of experiences where we experience light and
yep.
Fragrance and sound, I think that's, this is a wonderful place
mm-hmm.
to reconnect with our mm-hmm. bodies.
I think you've got it. Yep. I think you definitely have it. Absolutely.
I'm a little hesitant to share it. I'm born and raised in Ireland and left there 59 years ago. 58 years ago. We were married 58 years. but in my hometown, Limerick, there were churches within 1,000 yards of each other, you know, less than that. But they were all over the place. So about 6-7 years ago, we went back. Mostly we go back to visit my wife's family. They're massive. Not in size, just in numbers. But went back to my hometown, Limerick. And we decided to walk up to the nearest church to go to Mass. And Mass was at 9 o'clock, and the door wasn't open. And this was the place where I was confirmed, my first communion, a huge parish. And right about 8:58, the man came around to the front of the door, and he opened the door and said, "Well, welcome." We were one of maybe 15 people at Sunday Mass at 9 o'clock. The next church I went to visit was locked up. The next one after that was locked up. The next one we went to, they opened up on Sundays, but they were locked up the rest of the week. It was the saddest situation you ever saw. All of the young folks had walked away. And there weren't many older folks left that were interested. And even when we went up in the country, the saddest thing of all was on Sunday to go to Mass. and you could count everybody with no problem. So Ireland is in massive transition. I mean, we're noted for being, you know, huge Catholic church attendance. Sorry, it's in transition. Sorry to be the sadness.
Isn't that sad? Time to wind up. Just one last thing. The pendulum swings, okay? And I'd be a pessimist about the future of the church because it looks so bad, you know, in some places now. Except that we've survived for almost 2,000 years. And there was a time in England when the cathedrals were so empty that the doors would be open and the livestock would wander in and out in the 1700s. So maybe all of our churches are not like beautiful trees that we trim. They're like rose bushes. My wife was always cutting down a rose bush till I tell her there's nothing left. And she said, oh no, that's how you do it. And for reasons I don't understand, I think the Christian church is more like a rose bush than a tree. It almost has to be pruned down to nothing before it grows up. And I do want to respect our time. And yes, we're done. And thank you so very much for letting me do this.